From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! After a months-long battle, public school teachers in Puerto Rico vote against joining a union affiliated with the SEIU. We'll get the latest. Then workers in distress. Are John McCain and Barack Obama really addressing the needs of the working class? We'll host a discussion, and we'll take a look at the forgotten war, not Iraq or Afghanistan, but in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the conflict's threatening to explode once again. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. U.S. forces attacked a farm in eastern Syria near the Iraqi border Sunday, reportedly killing 8 civilians. Syria's official news agency said 4 U.S. helicopters crossed into Syria carrying the U.S. troops. The Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned what it described as an act of aggression. The attack is believed to mark the first time U.S. troops have launched an attack inside Syria since the start of the Iraq War. The Bush administration has accused Syria of not doing enough to stop anti-American forces from crossing the border into Iraq. A suspected U.S. missile strike inside Pakistan has killed up to 20 people. The target of the U.S. drone attack was a compound used by members of the Taliban. Since August, U.S. Predator drones have carried out at least 18 strikes inside Pakistan. The New York Times reports the CIA recently expanded its list of Pakistani targets and has gained approval from the government in Islamabad to bolster eavesdropping operations in the border region. The new head of Pakistan's spy service, the ISI, Ahmed Shuja Pasha, is in Washington this week to meet with CIA Director Michael Hayden. The Los Angeles Times reports senior Pentagon officials are considering sending additional teams of highly trained special operation forces to Afghanistan to target wanted militants. Many military leaders are increasingly arguing that an Iraq-style troop surge and counterinsurgency plan would not work because of the country's rugged geography and a history of resistance to rule from Kabul. In economic news, Japan's Nikkei stock index has fallen to a 26-year low as fear grows about a global recession. The Nikkei lost more than 6% today. Hong Kong's Hang Seng index tumbled nearly 13%. Death row prisoner Troy Davis was granted a stay of execution on Friday, 3 days before his scheduled execution. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Georgia gave Davis's lawyers 15 days to file documents with the court supporting defense claims that Davis is being wrongfully held in prison. The court will then decide if the case should go back before a lower court, which could order a new trial. In election news, a series of voting disputes in key swing states remain unresolved with just 8 days to go before the presidential election. In Colorado, more than 11,000 voters in Denver have not received absentee ballots because of a mistake made by the company Sequoia Voting Systems. Sequoia was supposed to have delivered 21,000 ballots to a Denver mail processing facility on October 16th, but the company only delivered about half the requested ballots. In other election news from Colorado, the Advancement Project has sued Colorado Secretary of State Mike Kaufman for his alleged illegal purge of voters across the state. The suit alleges between 16,000 and 30,000 voters were purged in violation of the National Voting Rights Act. Meanwhile, the White House is intervening in an election dispute in the state of Ohio. The White House has asked the Department of Justice to look into whether 200,000 new Ohio voters must reconfirm their registration information before the November 4th election because their records don't precisely match other government databases. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed a case brought by the Ohio Republican Party over the issue. On the campaign trail, over 100,000 people attended a Barack Obama rally in Denver, Colorado, yesterday. Another 45,000 showed up for a second rally in Colorado Springs. On Saturday, Obama campaigned in Reno, Nevada.
Somewhere in this crowd, there are parents or grandparents who said, "I may not have the right to vote, but my child, he might be able to run for the United States Senate. He might be able to run for the presidency of the United States of America." Nevada, that's the American dream. That's what we're fighting for. That's what this election is about.
At a rally in Denver, Senator John McCain continued his critique of Barack Obama's economic policies.
We're going to double the child deduction for every family. We'll cut the capital gains tax. We'll cut business taxes to help create jobs and keep American businesses in America. You know, as Joe the Plumber and small business owners across the country have now reminded us all, America didn't become the greatest nation on earth by giving our money to the government to spread the wealth around.
Barack Obama has picked up a series of prominent newspaper endorsements, including the Financial Times and the Anchorage Daily News, Alaska's largest newspaper. The Financial Times applauded Obama's handling of the financial crisis, saying he displayed a, quote, calm and methodical disposition, while McCain had offered, quote, hasty, half-baked interventions. The Anchorage Daily News said it was endorsing Obama in part because of McCain's selection of Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin to be his running mate. The paper said, quote, few who have worked closely with the governor would argue she's truly ready to assume command of the most important, powerful national on earth. On Friday, NBC broadcast a joint interview with McCain and Palin. When questioned by NBC's Brian Williams, Palin refused to say whether people who blew up abortion clinics are terrorists.
Is an abortion clinic bomber a terrorist under this definition, Governor?
There's no question that Bill Ayers, via his own admittance, was one who sought to destroy our U.S. Capitol and our Pentagon. That is a domestic terrorist. There's no question there. Now, others who would want to engage in harming innocent Americans or facilities that it would be unacceptable to, I don't know if you're going to use the word terrorist there.
The website Huffington Post has revealed John McCain traveled to Chile in 1985 to have a private meeting with Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet. According to a declassified U.S. embassy cable, McCain described the meeting with Pinochet as, quote, friendly and at times warm. At the time of the meeting, the U.S. Justice Department was seeking the extradition of two close Pinochet associates for an act of terrorism in Washington, D.C. The 1976 assassination of former Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier and his colleague Ronnie Moffatt. During his trip to Chile, McCain made no public or private statements critical of the dictatorship, nor did he meet with members of the Democratic opposition in Chile. The Republican Party in Pennsylvania sent out an email last week to 75,000 Jewish voters warning that an Obama victory could lead to a second Holocaust. The email read in part, quote, many of our ancestors ignored the warning signs in the 1930s and 1940s and made a tragic mistake. Let's not make a similar one this year. The email also claimed Obama had, quote, taught members of ACORN to commit voter registration fraud. The Republican Party is now disavowing the email, claiming a Republican consultant had sent it out without authorization. A Republican campaign worker has admitted she made up a story about being attacked by an African-American man in Pittsburgh because of a John McCain sticker. Ashley Todd had told police that a man had punched her in the back of the head, knocked her to the ground while threatening to teach her a lesson for being a McCain supporter. She claimed the man scratched a backward letter B on the right side of her face. Todd has been charged with filing a false police report. In news from Iraq, the McClatchy newspapers report the U.S. military has warned Iraq that it will shut down military operations and other vital services throughout the country on January 1st if the Iraqi government doesn't agree to a new agreement on the status of U.S. forces. Many Iraqi politicians said they view the move as akin to political blackmail. In addition to halting all military actions, U.S. forces would cease activities that support Iraq's economy, educational sector, and other areas. A new United Nations report has revealed major U.S. cities, including New York, Washington, Atlanta, and New Orleans, have levels of economic inequality that rival cities in Africa. The report found the United States has the highest inequality and poverty after Mexico and Turkey, and the gap has increased rapidly since 2000. The life expectancy of African Americans in the United States is about the same as that of people living in China and some states in India. In news from Africa, U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops are scheduled to begin a phased withdrawal from Somalia on November 21st under a ceasefire agreement between Somalia's transitional government and one faction of Islamist rebels. A ceasefire is set to begin on November 5th. Thousands of civilians have been killed in Somalia since the Ethiopian invasion in December of 2006. And in San Francisco, a landmark trial against Chevron begins today. 19 Nigerian plaintiffs have accused Chevron of recruiting and supplying Nigerian military forces involved in shooting and killing protesters in the oil-rich Niger Delta. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. After a battle that's been raging for months, public school teachers in Puerto Rico have voted against joining a union affiliated with the Service Employees International Union, or the SEIU. It's a major victory for the 42-year-old Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico, or FMPR. It was Puerto Rico's largest union, representing over 40,000 teachers. But earlier this year, after many months of trying to negotiate with the governor, the FMPR was decertified over its refusal to comply with a ban on strikes by public employees. The FMPR claims that the SEIU allied with Puerto Rican Governor Aníbal Acevedo Vilá and raided their leadership. The SEIU-affiliated union, the Puerto Rican Teachers Union, or SPM, lost by nearly 3,500 votes.
We're joined now by two guests. Rafael Feliciano is the president of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico, or FMPR. He joins us on the phone from San Juan. We're also joined from Boston by veteran labor organizer and reporter Steve Early, who has been closely following the debates in Puerto Rico. For more than a quarter of a century, he was an organizer for the Communication Workers of America. His forthcoming book is called Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. We did invite representatives of the SEIU to come on the broadcast, but they declined. Rafael Feliciano, Steve Early, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Rafael Feliciano. Can you talk about the defeat of SEIU in Puerto Rico? Why did members of the teachers' union vote not to affiliate with the SEIU-affiliated union?
Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity. In Puerto Rico, the teachers have a union. The FMPR is the union of the teachers in Puerto Rico. We developed a very strong strike in February of this year, and the government made an alliance with SEIU International Union to attack our union, to attack our teachers. Our union is a very democratic, rank-and-file union that have a commitment to develop a good education for our working class students, and we fight against charter schools and not shall left behind. Our struggle in the strike and all our struggle is very strong, and what the government do is make an alliance with the national to broke our movement, but our teachers both know to defeat that the SAE, FMP, SPM, that is was a union created by the bosses to attack our union and to substitute our union. But most of the teachers both know because they want union. They don't both know against the union. They both know to defeat the bosses' union and to affirm and to say that they want FMPR as their own union. And I think that this is a very big victory for all the workers of the world, because it's a victory of the rank and file. It's a victory of the union with social commitment, is a victory of the union as a working class mechanism to work for a better future for the workers.
Well, Rafael Feliciano, when your union was decertified by the government before you started your strike earlier this year, the new vote only had a yes or no on whether the teachers wanted to affiliate to the SEIU-backed union. Why did they not include your union on the ballot so that they got, so that the employees could have a choice?
Well, first of all, the victory of the no also says that the teachers, the workers, never decertify our union. the bosses, the government, decertify our union because we fight for our rights and we struggle for better education. What happened is that when the strike finished, we go to the teachers and they sign cards, and we have 11,000 of cards to be in the election. It's something like an inscription to the election. Well, what happened is that the government said that we cannot be in the election. They make a very bad interpretation of the law against us, and obviously the process was very anti-democratic because we have the signs to be in the election. We don't have any observers. We don't have the list of the voters. In between the last day of the election, for example, between the last day of the election and the day that the commission counts the votes, the persons that can be in the election go high 4,000. When the election begins, all the teachers in the election were 36,000. But they put so many votes inside, illegal votes, that at the end they say that our teachers were 40,000. Obviously, we won very open. We have a very open victory, and all the threats or all the things, bad things that they do in the commission, cannot stop our movement. And I think that they make a process with many illegal things to put that bosses union, that business union, to support SIU, but the government was defeated by the workers again.
We're talking to Rafael Feliciano, president of the Puerto Rican Teachers Union in San Juan. We're also joined by Steve Early in Boston, labor journalist. His forthcoming book is called Embedded with Organized Labor. Juan, I remember when you went down to Puerto Rico, this is in the midst of the campaign, the primaries. And in the end, isn't it true, Barack Obama did not go to Puerto Rico because of the massive protest of the teachers outside against SEIU, and he didn't want to get involved?
Yes, and actually, there were protests because SEIU was scheduling its convention, its annual convention in Puerto Rico this year, and there were protests, and some of the teachers who were protesting outside were arrested. But I'd like to ask Steve Early the implications of this vote for the continuing battles that are breaking out in the United States over SEIU, one of the fastest growing and supposedly one of the most progressive unions in the country, the implications of what has happened in Puerto Rico.
Well, I think this, as Rafi just said, Juan, was a tremendously important union representation vote. This is the largest bargaining unit in Puerto Rico. And I think it's really sad that at a time when the service employees and other unions are campaigning here on the mainland for Obama and campaigning for the enactment in 2009, hopefully, of legislation that will protect employees' free choice of a union in the private sector, that teachers in Puerto Rico didn't have that choice on the ballot last week. If the FMPR had been on the ballot, it certainly would have been reinstated with full collective bargaining rights. I think this is really a victory for the many people on the mainland who rallied to the side of the Puerto Rican teachers. There was a support committee formed in New York, out in California, to resist this North American Union raid. The Puerto Rican teachers organization that Rafi heads received financial support from the California Nurses, an independent union now affiliated with the AFL-CIO here. And within SEIU itself, dissident members, reform-minded delegates to the SEIU convention in Puerto Rico bravely protested the treatment of the teachers when they tried to picket the convention, when they were manhandled by the riot police. And I think this is going to embolden reformers within SEIU who, in California right now, are still resisting an attempt by the International Union to put the third largest SEIU local under trusteeship, United Healthcare Workers West, whose president, Sal Roselli, you had on the show last spring.
Steve Early, let me ask. When we tried to get SEIU to join us today, they said they were too busy involved with getting out the vote for Barack Obama and organizing on the campaign trail. What is the significance for this major union of this defeat in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think some of the developments in SEIU lately, the big corruption scandal in the union's second-largest local in Los Angeles, this dispute with the UHW, excuse me, in the Bay Area, this disgraceful intervention in Puerto Rico, these are tarnishing the image not only of SEIU, but all unions. And I think if we're going to succeed under an Obama administration with a Congress that will hopefully have more Democrats in the House and Senate in enacting legislation here on the mainland to strengthen workers' rights, and I'm referring to the Employee Free Choice Act, I don't think it helps that campaign when unions engage in conduct that besmirches the image of all labor. So I think as much as SEIU is doing in a valuable way to help with voter turnout and to help elect more pro-labor candidates in the election this fall, their actions in Puerto Rico, their internal behavior vis-a-vis their own members is not being helpful at this point.
And I'd like to go back to Rafael Feliciano in San Juan and ask you about the role of Dennis Rivera, who is who was a longtime leader of the 1199 here in New York, a national leader now of SEIU, and he spearheaded a lot of the efforts in Puerto Rico to bring the SEIU in. But you also have an election right there in Puerto Rico. You have a gubernatorial election coming up next week, but yet the governor of Puerto Rico and Dennis Rivera established, in essence, an alliance against you. Could you talk about that?
Yes. First of all, Dennis Rivera was direct intervention in the election against us. He was all in Ponce, taking the direction of the election against us. Personally, but I want to say to you that Dennis Rivera and the government make an alliance. SEIU said that they will put money for the reelection campaign of Aníbal Acevedo Vilá, that is the governor of Puerto Rico. We said that is very bad for the labor movement because they make a compromise with the bosses and with the dominant class in Puerto Rico against the workers. The alliance was they put money for the reelection of Aníbal Acevedo Vilá, and Aníbal Acevedo Vilá used his own influence in the Department of Education and in the courts to attack our union. But at the end, the people that suffers that kind of action are the workers first. The teachers, most of them are women, but also our students, because in his attack to Federación, they make many things bad for our Department of Education and for the educational process in Puerto Rico. We think that our victory is a victory against the dominant class. That make a little crack in the hegemony of the bourgeoisie of Puerto Rico against the workers, and also is a big lesson to all the workers. If we have a very strong rank and file union, if we have a very democratic union, if the decision is taken from the bottom, we can make a strike and we can defeat the alliance of many sectors of the dominant class. And also, more important of all, that is that we can develop a real class conscience in our workers, in our people.
Rafael Feliciano, we want to thank you for being with us, president of the Puerto Rican Teachers Union, speaking to us from San Juan. Steve Early, stay with us in Boston. As we go on to talk about distressed workers around the country, the working class in this country in this time of a global economic meltdown, we will also be joined by Michael Zweig, who has a new report on distressed workers. And Stephen Greenhouse writes for The New York Times about the working class in America. Stay with us. And Feeney, it was great to see her there at the Gandhi King Conference for Peacemakers last weekend in Memphis, Tennessee. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Election Day is 8 days away, and the country remains in the midst of a deep economic crisis that many have compared to the Great Depression. The economy is the number one issue on the campaign trail, and the major party candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, discussed their tax plans, jobs, and the financial bailout on the stump. But no one is really talking about the working class in this country and the impact of the financial meltdown on their lives. A new study from the Center for the Study of Working Class Life suggests that neither McCain nor Obama have adequately spoken to the needs of one-fifth of the population, the 60 million Americans who are barely surviving in this economy.
Michael Zweig is one of the authors of the study called Economic Stimulus and Economically Distressed Workers. He's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at State University of New York, Stony Brook. His most recent book, What's Class Got to Do with It? American Society in the 21st Century. He joins us in our Firehouse studio. We're also joined here in New York by labor and workplace reporter for The New York Times, Stephen Greenhouse. His latest book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. And labor journalist Steve Early is still with us in Boston. Michael Zweig, lay it out. Who are economically distressed workers in this country? And what is the picture of working class in this country?
Well, the working class is having a hard time in this country. And when we talk about economically distressed workers or people, we're talking about people whose incomes are so low that they can't get above the bottom of their housing market.
What was called the working poor?
Well, we started out calling them the working poor, and we found that really it wasn't the best term because we want to work in a way that engages people in the process. And when nobody wants to be poor, nobody wants to be called poor or low wage. So when we started out talking about the working poor or low wage workers, we came in the course of conversations with these workers to understand that maybe it would be better to find another way to talk about it. So that's why we came up with this formulation, economically distressed, which really talks about the content of their lives rather than something which might get turned into an epithet. So these economically distressed workers are people whose incomes are so low that they can't get out of the bottom of their own housing market in their area for a family of their size without spending more than 30% of their income to do that. And the federal standard is 30%. You shouldn't spend more than 30% of your income on housing, otherwise you won't have enough money for everything else that you need. So that's how we look at the problem. And we found that in the United States, it's almost 21% of the labor force are people who are in this economically distressed status. And it varies. In metropolitan areas, it's higher. Here in New York, I just have the numbers just here. It's in New York metropolitan area, 29.4% of the families and households in the New York metro area are economically distressed. And it goes as high as in Miami, it's 32.4%. So in Los Angeles, it's 31%. So we're talking about really a lot of people who are in very, very serious situation.
Well, Steve Greenhouse, on the campaign trail, John McCain talks about Joe the plumber. Barack Obama talks about the middle class and tax cuts and policies that address the middle class. Why aren't either one of them talking about this sector?
There, first, the phrase working class is kind of forbidden from political talk in the United States because it's people are going to be accused of being class warriors. So unfortunately, that phrase is rarely used. But I think the catchphrase is the middle class. They're both focusing on the middle class. But we have this ever-expansive definition of what the middle class is, people from $20,000 a year to $200,000 a year. But I think, you know, the silver lining in the current crisis is that, you know, finally, after years of ignoring what's happening to the nation's workers, the candidates are starting to talk to some of these issues: foreclosures, high debt levels, the large number of uninsured. I think Obama, you know, has come up with some plans where he's really trying to address this, you know, the freeze on foreclosures, to pump billions of dollars into investment in infrastructure, into green industries. And McCain, in his own way, is also trying to do it, you know, mainly in the traditional Republican way of tax cuts, and he's hoping that there'll be a trickle down from investors and entrepreneurs down to help workers.
Talk about how the candidates are talking about the working class. I mean, of course, the buzzword of Obama is the middle class. Everywhere he goes, it's a little hard for McCain even to say the middle class. I mean, in the debates, I think, and one of the first ones, he never said it once. But working class is out.
Yes, you're right, Amy. Working class is out. But they do try to talk to the problems that average Americans are having, that people maybe earning less than $50,000 a year are having. You know, the people who face foreclosures, the people who've been thrown out of work, the people who are, you know, up to their eyes in debt. But they don't use the phrase working class. But, you know, I think both of them know when they campaign in Ohio, Wisconsin, West Virginia, North Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania, that a lot of people are hurting, and they're trying to address those issues. And they say, you know, we want to do something. And Obama, I think, in the past few weeks, has really learned from lessons from Hillary Clinton, that he wants to show that he's battling for them. I think for a long time, Congress, the president, you know, and this is a big point I make in my book, is, you know, for years, Washington was ignoring the squeeze on the nation's workers. Now, a silver lining in the current crisis is that, wow, people are saying, the nation's workers are hurting very, very badly. Wages have been stagnant. Health insurance is getting worse. 401ks are going down the drain. Americans are working more hours than people in any other industrialized nation. So I think, you know, Obama, with his tax plan, wants to, you know, reduce some of the inequality by, you know, increasing taxes on those making more than $250,000 a year to help those down below. And he has some child tax credits and education credits, I think, are designed specifically to help those on the bottom most.
Michael Schwein.
You know, there was some talk about the working class, particularly in the primaries, when the real question there was, can Barack Obama score with the working class, by which people meant white people. So, you know, there was a kind of conflation there of race and class. And the idea that Hillary Clinton had a lock on the working class forgetting that all these black workers who were voting for Obama are also in the working class. So I think that there was some opening there to talk about the working class. And there is a discussion, of course, of class war. Every time anybody talks about redistributing income down, oh, that's class warfare. Well, yes, it is class warfare to redistribute the income up. We've been living for 35 years in a period of intense class warfare, except the working class has been losing. And part of that class warfare is to deny that there are classes and to deny that any of this dynamic is actually happening so that people's attention are shifted elsewhere. And that's why I think that it's so important to keep talking about and bringing back into focus what is actually happening with working people in this country.
Yeah. There's this great quote from Warren Buffett where he says, you know, there's class warfare going on, but it's my class, the rich class, that's winning, because if you look at increased inequality in the nation, the wealthy are just zooming upwards while people in the bottom half, bottom quarter, have really been squeezed very badly.
I'd like to bring in Steve Zweig again on the, Steve Early in Boston. I'd like to ask you about the response of organized labor, which obviously has been the fulcrum of the American working class now for a century or more than a century, in terms of how the organized labor is responding to the current crisis, economic crisis and attack. We just heard news, for instance, that General Motors, which originally had negotiated a deal with the UAW to take early workers out, new workers out of their pension plan and give them 401ks, now with the crisis GM is facing, they're talking about reducing their contribution to that retirement fund, those 401ks for workers. How is labor responding to this crisis?
Well, on the political front, unions are trying to make the point that what we need now, what we need next year, if there's a big Democratic majority in Congress and Obama is elected, is the same sort of remedy that was provided by the New Deal in 1935 through passage of the National Labor Relations Act, which labor is trying to amend now through enactment of the Employee Free Choice Act. And that is a strengthening of workers' collective bargaining rights. If workers were able to negotiate again on a wide scale in the private sector about pensions, about health care, about wages, they would have a powerful new tool to address these terrible cutbacks that are already being imposed unilaterally in hundreds of thousands of non-union workplaces where people are losing their retirement savings. Health care costs are being shifted to the workers, and we're looking at a recession where there's going to be wage stagnation and possibly pay cuts in the 3 to 7% range that workers have experienced in past recessions. So this is something the candidates are not talking about. Biden and Obama did not mention the Employee Free Choice Act in any of the presidential or vice presidential debates so far. They only talk about it in front of labor audiences, and they need to start talking about strengthening of workers' rights as a way of reviving worker purchasing power, restoring collective bargaining to this country, and enabling workers to do in 2009 and beyond what they were able to do in this country in the late 1930s after passage of the National Labor Relations Act.
And they're also not talking about the expected high the increase in unemployment, which everyone knows is going to happen over the next few months. It'll be the fallout of the financial crisis. And no one seems to be talking about the looming unemployment problem in the country.
I would agree. I think the Democrats' initial recovery package or rescue package, which they enacted earlier this year, was sorely lacking in any real improvements in unemployment insurance. That also was an innovation of the New Deal in the 1930s. Unemployment benefits today cover only a fraction of the jobless population. And again, this is an area where we need rapid government intervention. We need an injection of new funding. We need a safety net that's real, that's not full of holes.
What about General Motors and Chrysler? What does this mean for working people, especially in places like Michigan?
Well, I think any consolidation of corporations of that scale is going to result in further job elimination. Certainly those most at risk are the salaried and management people who have no protection against termination or freeze of their pension plans, who can be laid off in any fashion. The UAW is going to have some difficult negotiating ahead of it to deal with the fallout of that kind of consolidation.
What do you think of such a bailout, Stephen Greenhouse?
The financial bailout or the GM Chrysler bailout? The financial bailout, my sense is, you know, none of us love the idea of throwing money at bankers who've been very irresponsible, but I think we have to realize that, you know, if we did not bail out Wall Street, the stock market would melt down, and then Main Street would have started to melt down as well. I do think that the banks that have received the bailout, you know, clearly have made known that they're not doing enough with the money to, you know, to lend it to the people who need it. So I think the federal government really has to start, really should start leaning on the banks a little more to, you know, make this money available to Main Street to help Main Street recover, the same way that the British government has done to British banks.
Well, I'd like to ask about the another looming crisis that gets very little attention so far, are the employee pension funds. With this dramatic drop in the stock market, certainly, especially government and municipal pension funds have taken astronomical hits in terms of what the value, how much money they have left to pay out pension benefits, what this is going to mean for government workers over the next few years.
It's going to be very painful, both for government workers and for taxpayers, because as you know, Wall Street has dropped, the amount of money in pension funds has dropped. So cities and states, you know, will now tell their employees, "Hey, we don't have enough money to pay for your pensions." So they might propose different things to reduce pensions, which will be bad for the workers. But on the other hand, New Jersey and other states that are struggling with pension burdens might have to cough up billions, maybe even tens of billions of dollars to pay, and taxpayers are not going to like that either, especially when their pocketbooks are being hit by the downturn.
Michael's why?
Well, it's also, I think, the case that these are losses that are very big, but they're also, in a certain way, paper losses. These pension funds have these hundreds of billions of dollars in these funds. But they're not cashing all that money in right now to get the money so that they can pay these pensions. So there is, in a certain sense, it's a little bit premature to say that this is a long-term crisis for the pension funds, because it may be that in 2 or 3 years or 4 years, the market will recover enough of its value that we won't have such a major catastrophe as one might think, just looking at the numbers as they are today. I would like to come back just again to this question of what do we do now to really help people. We are going into a recession, it seems very clear, and there's going to be a lot more unemployment. One of the things that we did in our study is we looked at what does it take to stimulate the economy to get it back towards full employment in a way that helps ordinary working people and these economically distressed workers. And we have a stimulus package of around $220 billion that we think will do that. When we first proposed that $220 billion at the beginning of September, we started writing it up, and people said, that's an impossible sum of money. Nobody can ever imagine coming up with $220 billion. 3 weeks later, they came up with $700 billion, of which they only committed $350, right? So there's still $350 billion left on the table in Washington that the Congress has already committed to economic recovery, whatever that might mean. And we're saying, well, why doesn't that mean take $220 of that remaining $350 and develop a real stimulus package that will help and send resources directly to people in the form of increased unemployment compensation, in the form of earned income tax credit extensions, in the form of support to local governments so that they don't have to cut Medicaid or they can restore the cuts in Medicaid, in the form of checks that would go out to people so that, you know, at the lower end of the income distribution, families making less than $50,000 a year, there's 55 million of those families. Send them each an average check of $2,000. It's $110 billion. It would go immediately into helping the economy. And it would be the complement of bailing out the financial sector so that when there's credit available again, there will be a reason to actually for somebody to borrow because there will be some demand for the products.
How has Joe the Plumber skewed this debate? On the one hand, you'd think he'd be the person talking about what about the working class. In fact, in his own personal circumstances, he is a part of that, though he is identifying with management. He is, right, not a licensed plumber.
Joe the Plumber and the use of Joe the Plumber has muddied the waters. I mean, you know, McCain has portrayed him as a working class stiff. But he says he's about to make $250,000 a year. How many working class people really make $250,000 a year? And then I think, you know, Obama said, look, I wanted to help you, Joe the Plumber, when you were coming up and earning just $30,000 to $50,000 a year. But if you're earning $250,000 a year, you're doing pretty well. But, you know, but the unfortunate thing about the whole Joe the Plumber debate, Amy, is that it's really caused both candidates not to focus so much on the real members of the working class who are making $25,000, $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a year. All those people wish they were Joe the Plumber making $250,000 a year. And McCain, I think, has in ways distracted Obama from focusing more on issues like, you know, how do we provide health insurance to the 46 million Americans without health insurance? You know, and when McCain, you know, condemns the whole idea of spread the wealth, I think of, you know, his hero Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who was one of the fathers of the progressive income tax, and has said it's important, you know, when there's prosperity that we pass the prosperity around so everyone can benefit.
Well, I'd like to ask you about another part of the working class, the other part of the working class that's gotten no attention, immigrants. The undocumented immigrants in the country. It seems that there's been almost an unwritten agreement among both candidates and the media not to ask Obama or McCain about their immigration policy since the primaries. Once the primaries were over, the debate is over in terms of the national debate. Your sense?
It's really quite interesting that that's true. I didn't expect that. I thought that the immigration question would be really a much larger one. Of course, McCain has a fairly liberal view towards immigration in the sense that he doesn't want to just expel everybody and lock them all up.
So much so that Lou Dobbs and Fox, they were calling him Juan McCain.
Is that right? Well, you know, you have a situation there where maybe there's not that big of a difference, and these candidates have decided and their campaigns have decided that that's just too much of a third rail. And it's too emotional, and it's too crazy, and they're just not going to get into
it. They
don't. Yeah, they don't need to get into it. And each has enough in them, in their backgrounds and in their programs, that Lou Dobbs and that whole militant anti-immigrant crowd is going to be dissatisfied with both of them. So why get into it?
But there is the issue of will they continue to build a wall? Will they continue to prosecute? Have the raids? Massive raids.
But you can't get into those questions with them without opening the whole question of immigration. I think what they've done is they've decided they're just not going to talk about the whole question of immigration, and then we can only be left to guess. What will they actually do? You know, I will say that in the immigration situation, whatever happens, we want to make sure that there isn't a two-tier labor force that we have in this country, where the immigrants, in whatever form they're here, as guest workers or in whatever guise we sort of allow them to come into America, that they are some second-class labor citizen. That, I think, we really have to be very careful about. And I will say about the Employee Free Choice Act that Steve Early was talking about before, it's a very, very important thing. On the other hand, I'm concerned that a Democratic administration in Congress is going to give the labor movement an Employee Free Choice Act.
Which means
that the principal legislative agenda item for the labor movement to make it easier to organize unions will be enacted, probably quite early. And then the labor movement is going to be told, you go organize your workers and don't bother us anymore with any other questions because now we have serious business to attend to and all the rest of the agenda of the government. And labor is going to be cut out in issues of the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan, in issues of the reconstruction of the banking regulations, in issues of housing and all the other items that are so very important to working people in this country. The labor movement is going to get its piece in the Employee Free Choice Act. And in much the same way that the Clinton administration gave labor the Employee Family Leave Act, unpaid, but still a Family Leave Act in 1993 was a very important thing, but that was pretty much the end of labor's agenda in the Clinton years. And the rest of it was devoted to deregulating the financial industry and ending welfare as we know it. And so I'm a little concerned that we are going to be in a situation where we put so much weight on the Employee Free Choice Act that we are going to be left aside in the other deliberations.
I see something somewhat differently from Mike. I think the unions are playing their hand pretty well this election. They're going all out to help Obama, and clearly, you know, if Obama's elected, they're going to expect, you know, him to implement some of the things they're pushing for, and they're pushing for three things at once. One is this Employee Free Choice Act, which would make it easier for workers to unionize. Second, they're pushing very, very, very hard for economic stimulus, which dovetails with what a lot of liberal Democrats want anyway. And third, they're pushing very, very hard for universal health coverage, and that's something Obama has promised. So I think they'll feel very, very angry if Obama says, we gave you Employee Free Choice Act, and we're going to ignore you on other things. The other things they're pushing for are the very things that many, many Democrats are pushing for.
Last word. You have 30 seconds. Steve Early.
I think it's overly optimistic to assume that the Employee Free Choice Act, expanding the right to organize in this country is going to sail through the new Congress. You look back at the history of labor law reform efforts over the last 30 years under Clinton and Carter, a lot of disappointment and a record of failure. It's going to take a tremendous grassroots movement now and then by organized workers to keep the pressure on Obama and the Democrats to make this long overdue change so that workers can organize more freely without management interference. It's not a done deal, and I think Obama would prefer to avoid a knockdown, drag-out fight with corporate America over this issue right out of the box.
Steve Early, I want to thank you for being with us. Steve Early, Boston-based labor journalist, Stephen Greenhouse with The New York Times, his book, The Big Squeeze, and Michael Zweig, joining us from State University of New York, Stony Brook. He is the head of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at SUNY Stony Brook. His book, What's Class Got to Do With It? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Kana motema eko lukandongo bandeko e
bomba makambwe bomba makambwe
likambwe bomba mboka o biloba loba likambwe bomba mboka o songi songi bandeko e
bomba makambwe bomba makambwe
Zalana maele, soki oyoki likambo, zalana maele, tango bako tuna yo bandeko.
Bomba makambo, bomba makambo.
Music by Franco, Likambo ya Ngana, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The so-called forgotten war, the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, is threatening to explode once again, away from the glare of any international media attention. On Sunday, rebel commanders led by Laurent Nkunda seized an army base in the headquarters of Congo's famous Virunga National Park. The fighting between Nkunda's forces and the Congolese army has increased since August, in part over the government's alleged alliance with Hutu militias from Rwanda. Nkunda claims to be defending ethnic Tutsis in the area, and the Rwandan government has accused the DRC of supporting militias responsible for the 1994 genocide of Tutsis. Rwanda has invaded the DRC three times in the past 12 years, twice sparking civil wars. The latest round of fighting has seen a dramatic rise in the number of rapes, and some 200,000 people have been displaced since August, according to the World Food Program. That's in addition to the nearly 1.5 million people already displaced from this part of the country since 2007.
Bringing attention to the dire situation in the Congo and role of Western corporations in fueling the conflict was the focus of Congo Week, awareness-raising week of events last week across the country on campuses. Kambale Musavuli is a Congolese engineering student at North Carolina AT&T University. He helped coordinate Congo Week with the group Friends of the Congo. Joining us now from Washington, D.C., what do you think is the most important issue for people in this country to understand as you come out of Congo Week, a war that very few people in this country know about?
Yes, thank you for having me on the show. Really main important things that people should know that is the war in the Congo is directly connected to the United States as far as resource exploitation is concerned. What we wanted to do coming out of Congo Week and is to show that connection as well as be able to provide enough information to the world community and U.S.-based universities on how they can help support the Congolese to regain the sovereignty on the land, understanding that the conflict in the Congo is based on resource exploitation, which we're seeing in the later years from the invasion of Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi in the eastern part of the Congo.
When you say directly connected to the United States, what firms are in the Congo, and what are they doing to fuel the conflict?
There are numerous firms. I will go with the Dan Rather report that just came out last month about oil mines, Freeport, McMoRan out of Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. They are exploiting the copper out of the Congo. Dan Rather did a wonderful job showing how Freeport McMoRan is doing so. Cabot Corporation out of Boston, Massachusetts, is another company that was mentioned in the UN report of 2001 and 2003 on the exploitation of coltan, and coltan being one a resource that's found in virtually every electronic device, such as cell phones, laptop, DVD players. And understanding that the root cause of the conflict in the Congo is the scramble for Congo's mineral resources is what actually is making us, the youth of the Congo, to go out to the world and be able to connect with people of goodwill, letting them know that the strife is not more so of an ethnic strife, but more so of the scramble for Congo's mineral resources.
What about the issue of the epidemic of rapes in Congo?
The rapes are a direct result of the war. We're seeing it, the latest spasm that we're seeing right now has been going on since 96. The rapes, the murders, they all are being done as a way of mass displacement, if you have to put it in the context. As one person is brutalized in a community, the people in the neighborhood will be afraid, and that will cause them to be displaced. As you mentioned, we have about 1.5 million people internally displaced in the Congo. As this strategy has been used in the eastern part, we've seen masses of people being displaced from their villages, from their cities, simply because they live in rich area rich of minerals. Now we're seeing it very clearly. The Virunga Park was taken over yesterday, simply because there are resources that Laurent Kunda exploit into the Virunga part. So to end the rape, you must end the conflict. And to end the conflict, you must stop the resource exploitation of the Congo, thus creating a platform for the Congolese people to be sovereign and free. And a few prescriptions that I may mention would be to put pressure on Rwanda, because we do know that Rwanda is supporting proxy forces in the eastern part of the Congo. And we can use such people with Kagame's ear, such as Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Cindy McCain, Rick Warren, to put pressure on Kagame to make sure that we do not see another nearly 6 million people dying in the eastern part of the Congo, simply because of a blessing of land. The people who are exploiting those resources are cursed as they continue to create the conflict at the detriment of the Congolese people.
Kambale, we only have about 30 seconds, but you also organized a cell phone protest yesterday. Explain.
Yes, what we have asked people to do to show the connection with coltan is to turn off the cell phone last week on Wednesday, October 22nd, and change their voicemail, because we believe that people will call their phone still, and explaining why their phone is off during that day. Our aim, really, during the cell phone boycott is to raise awareness about what's happening in the Congo, and using the cell phone as a messaging tool was very, very successful. We had students in New Zealand, high school in Heavenside, that actually did that perfectly, getting the whole high school to participate in that. So our aim into the sellout as well as Congo Week is basically to end the conflict and provide support to the Congolese people in their quest to regain sovereignty of their land.
Kambale Musavuli, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The coltan used in cell phones from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's an engineering student at North Carolina A&T State University, helped coordinate Congo Week. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifo Dokadus, Aramante, Angeli Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and special thanks to Peter Curries, as well as Nick Gila, for helping with today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. This is